Damn, pay dirt, he exclaimed, and stepped into the closet. He planted one foot on either side of the sitting corpse's body, but that made him acutely uncomfortable. He had once gotten head from a woman who had been sitting against a bedroom wall in almost that exact same position. At a party in East Hampton, that had been. Spielberg had been there. Joyce Carol Oates, too. He stepped back, put one foot on the corpse's shoulder, and pushed. The woman's body slid slowly and stiffly to the right. Her huge red eye socket seemed to stare at him with an expression of surprise as she went, as if she were wondering how a cultured fellow such as himself, a National Book Award winner, for goodness sake, could possibly stoop to pushing over a lady in a closet. Tendrils of her hair slid along the wall, trailing after her. "Sorry, ma'am," he said, "but it's better for both of us this way, believe me." The guns were held in place by a length of cable threaded through the trigger guards. The cable was padlocked to an eye bolt on the side of the case. Johnny hoped he would have better luck finding the key to this lock than he'd had finding the one that opened the box with the Ruger in it. The third key he tried popped the padlock. He stripped the cable back through the trigger guards with a jerk so hard that one of them, a Remington 30-06, came tumbling out. He caught it, turned, and the woman, Mary, was standing right there. Johnny gave a strangled little whoop that probably would have been a scream if he hadn't been so scared. His heart stopped beating, and for one very long moment he was positive it wasn't going to restart. He'd be dead of fright even before he fell backward onto the corpse in the silk shirt. Then, thank God, it got going again. He slammed a fist into his chest just above the left nipple, an area which had once been hard and now wasn't very, just to show the pump underneath who was the boss. "Don't ever do that," he told Mary, trying not to wheeze. "What's wrong with you?" "I thought you heard me." She didn't look terribly sympathetic. There was a golf bag, of all things, slung over her shoulder. A tartan golf bag. She looked at the corpse in the closet. There's a body in the fire chief's closet, too. A man. What was his handicap? Any idea? His heart was still galloping, but maybe not so fast now. "You never quit, do you?" "Fuck you, Mary. I'm trying to kid myself out of dying here. Every martini I ever drank just jumped on my heart. Christ, you scared me." "I'm sorry, but we've got to hurry up. He could come back any time." A concept that never crossed my poor excuse for a mind. "Here, take this, and be careful." He handed her the 30-06, thinking of an old Tom Waits song. "Black Crow Shells from a 30-06. Waits sang in his stripped and somehow ghoulish voice, "whittle you into kindling." "How careful? Is it loaded?" "I don't even remember how to check. I did a tour of Vietnam, but as a journalist. That was a long time ago in any case. The only guns I've seen fired since then have been on movie screens. We'll figure the guns out later, okay?" She put it gingerly into the golf bag. "I found two flashlights. They both work. One's a long barrel job, very bright." "Good." He handed her the flashlight he had found. "The bag was hung on the back of the door," Mary said, dropping the flashlight in. "The fire chief, if it was him. Well, one of the clubs was stuck down through the top of his head. Way down. He was sort of skewered on it." Johnny took two more rifles and the shotgun from the rack and turned with them in his arms. If the walnut doodad on the floor below the rack contained ammo, as he assumed it did, all would be well. A rifle or shotgun for each of the grown-ups. The kid could have Sheriff Jim's 45 back. Shit, the kid could have any gun he wanted, as far as Johnny was concerned. So far, at least, David Carver was the only one of them who had demonstrated he could use one if he had to. "I'm sorry you had to see that," he said, helping Mary ease the guns into the golf bag. She shook her head impatiently, as if that wasn't the point. How much strength would it take to do something like that? To push the handle of a golf club down through a man's head and neck and right into his chest? To push it down until there was nothing but the head sticking up like a... A little hat or something. I don't know. A lot, I guess. But Antragian's a moose. A moose indeed. But now that she'd put it in this light, it did seem strange. It's the level of violence that scares me the most, she said. The ferocity. That woman in the closet. Her eyes are gone, aren't they? Yes. The Carver's little girl. What he did to Peter, shooting him point blank in the stomach over and over. The people out there hung up like deer in hunting season. Do you see what I mean? Of course. And you're not even touching the rest of it, Mary, he thought. He's not just a serial killer. He's the Bram Stoker version of Dr. Doolittle. She looked around nervously as a particularly strong gust of wind hit the building. It doesn't matter where we go next as long as we're out of here. Come on, for God's sake. Right, just 30 seconds, okay? He knelt by the woman's legs, smelling blood and perfume. He went through the keys again, and this time had almost reached the end of his choices before one popped the lock on what did indeed turn out to be a small but exceedingly well-stocked ammo chest. He took 8 or 9 boxes of shells, ones he hoped would fit the weapons he had already taken, and dumped them into the golf bag. "I'll never be able to carry all that," Mary said. "That's okay. I will." Except he couldn't. He was ashamed to find he couldn't even get the golf bag off the floor, let alone sling it over his shoulder. "If the bitch hadn't scared me so bad," he thought, and then had to laugh at himself. He really did. "What are you grinning about?" she asked him sharply. "Nothing." He made the grin disappear. "Here, grab the strap. Help me pull it." Together, they dragged the bag across the floor, Mary keeping her head down and her eyes fixed firmly on the steel bouquet of protruding gun barrels as they came around the counter and back toward the door. Johnny took a single look up at the hanging corpses and thought, the storm, the coyotes sitting along the road like an honor guard, the one in the holding area, the buzzards, the dead. How comforting it would be to believe this was all an adventure in dreamland. But it wasn't. He had only to sniff the sour aroma of his own sweat through the clogged and painful channels of his nose to be sure of that. Something beyond anything he had ever believed, anything he had ever considered believing, was happening here, and it wasn't a dream. "That's it. Don't look," he panted. "I'm not, don't worry," she replied. Johnny was pleased to hear her panting a little, too. Out in the hall, the wind was louder than ever. Ralph was standing at the doors with his arm curled around his son's shoulders, looking out. The old guy was behind them. They all turned to Johnny and Mary. "We hear a motor," David said at once. "We think we did," Ralph amended. "Was it the cruiser?" Mary asked. She pulled one of the rifles out of the golf bag, and when the barrel drifted toward Billingsley, he pushed it away again with the flat of his hand, grimacing. "I'm not even sure it was a motor," Ralph said. "The wind..." "It wasn't the wind," David said. "See any headlights?" Johnny asked. David shook his head. "No, but the sand is flying so thick." Johnny looked from the gun Mary was holding. The barrel was now pointed at the floor, which seemed like a step in the right direction, to the others protruding from the golf bag, to Ralph. Ralph shrugged and looked at the old man. Billingsley caught the look and sighed. "Go on, dump 'em out," he said. "Let's see what you've got." "Can't this wait?" Mary asked. "If that psycho comes back..." "My boy says he saw more coyotes out there," Ralph Carver said. "We shouldn't take a chance on getting savaged, ma'am." "For the last time, it's Mary, not ma'am," she said crossly. "Okay, all right, but hurry." Johnny and Ralph held the golf bag while Billingsley pulled the rifles out and handed them to David. "Put 'em a row," he said. And David did, lining them up neatly at the foot of the stairs, where the light from the clerk's area would fall on them. Ralph picked the bag up and tipped it. Johnny and Mary caught the flashlights and shells as they slid out. The old man handed the ammunition to David a box at a time, telling him which guns to put them by. They finished with three boxes stacked by the .30-06 and none by the gun on the end. "You didn't get nothing that'll fit that Mossberg," he said. "It's a damn fine gun, but it's chambered for .22s. You want to go back and see if you can find some .22s?
"No," Mary said immediately.
Johnny looked at her, irritated. He didn't like women answering questions that had been aimed at him, and then let it go. She was right. "There's no time," he told Billingsley. "We'll carry it anyway, though. Somebody in town'll have .22s. You take it, Mary."
"No thanks," she said coolly, and selected the shotgun, which the veterinarian had identified as a Rossi 12-gauge. "If it's to be used as a club instead of a firearm, it ought to be a man who swings it. Don't you agree?"
Johnny realized he had been mousetrapped. Quite neatly, too.
"You bitch," he thought, and might have said it aloud, husband hung on a coat hook or not, except that David Carver cried out, "Truck!" at that moment, and tore open one of the municipal building's glass doors. They had been hearing the wind for some time now, and had felt it shake the brick building they were in, but none of them was quite prepared for the ferocity of the gust that ripped the door out of David's hand and slammed it against the wall hard enough to crack the glass. The poster's thumbtack to the hallway bulletin board rattled. Some tore free and went swirling up the stairwell. Sand sheeted in, stinging Johnny's face. He put a hand up to shield his eyes and accidentally bumped his nose instead. He yelled with pain.
"David!" Ralph cried and grabbed for his son's shirt. Too late. The boy darted out into the howling dark, unmindful of anything that might be waiting. And now Johnny understood what had galvanized David. Headlights. Turning headlights that swept across the street from right to left as if mounted on a gimbal. Sand danced wildly in the moving beams.
"Hey!" David screamed, waving his arms. "Hey, you! You in the truck!"
The headlights began to ebb. Johnny snatched up one of the flashlights from the floor and ran out after the Carvers. The wind assaulted him, making him stagger on his feet and grab at the door jamb so he wouldn't go tumbling off the steps. David had run into the middle of the street, dropping one shoulder to dodge a dark, speeding object which Johnny at first thought was a buzzard. He clicked on the flashlight and saw a tumbleweed instead. He turned the flashlight toward the departing taillights and swung it back and forth in an arc, slitting his eyes against the sand. The light appeared puny in the sand-thickened dark.
"Hey!" David screamed.
His father was behind him, the revolver in his hand. He was trying to look in all directions at once, like a presidential bodyguard who senses danger.
"Hey! Come back!"
The taillights were receding, heading north along the road which led back to Highway 50. The blinker was dancing in the wind, and Johnny caught just a glimpse of the departing truck in its stuttery glow. A panel job with something printed on the back. He couldn't read it. There was too much flying sand.
"Get back inside, you guys," he shouted. "It's gone."
The boys stood in the street a moment longer, looking toward where the taillights had disappeared. His shoulders were slumped. His father touched one of his hands.
"Come on, David. We don't need that truck. We're in town. We'll just find someone who can help us, and..."
He trailed off, looking around and seeing what Johnny had seen already. The town was dark. That might only mean that people were hunkered down, that they knew what had been happening and were hiding from the crazy man until the cavalry arrived. That made a certain degree of sense, but it wasn't how it felt to Johnny's heart. To his heart, the town felt like a graveyard. David and his father started back toward the steps, the boy head down dejected, the man still looking everywhere for trouble. Mary stood in the doorway, watching them come, and Johnny thought she looked extraordinarily beautiful, with her hair flying around her head.
"The truck, Johnny. Was there something about the truck?"
"There was, wasn't there?" Terry's voice.
Howls rose in the windy dark. They sounded mocking, like laughter, and seemed to come from everywhere. Johnny hardly heard them. Yes, something about the truck. Definitely. About the size of it, and the lettering, and just the look of it, even in the dark and the blowing sand. Something... Oh, shit! He cried, and clutched his chest again. Not at his heart, not this time, but for a pocket that was no longer there. In his mind's eye, he saw the coyote shaking his expensive motorcycle jacket back and forth, ripping the lining, spilling shit to the four points of the compass, including... What? Mary asked, alarmed at the look on his face. What?
You all better get back in here till these guns are loaded, Billingsley told them, unless you want some varmint down on you.
Johnny barely heard that, either. The letters on the back of the truck receding into the windy dark could have spelled Ryder. It made sense, didn't it? Steve Ames was looking for him. He had poked his head into desperation, seen nothing, and was now driving out of town again to look somewhere else. Johnny leaped past the astonished Billingsley, down on one knee loading guns, and pelted upstairs toward the holding area, praying to David Carver's God that his cellular telephone was still intact. 4. If things are normal, feel normal, Steve Ames had said, we'll try reporting it there. But if we see anything that looks the slightest bit wrong, we head for Ely on the double. And, as the Ryder truck sat idling beneath the dancing blinker light which marked desperation's only intersection, Cynthia reached out and twitched Steve's shirt. Time to head for Ely, she said, and pointed out her window, west along the cross street. Bikes in the street down there, see them? My old Grammy used to say bikes in the street are one of those big-time whammies, like breaking a mirror or leaving a hat on the bed. Time to boogie.
Your Grammy said that, huh?
Actually, I never had a Grammy, not one that I knew anyway, but get real. What are they doing there? Why hasn't anybody taken them out of the storm? Don't you see how wrong all this is? He looked at the bikes, which were lying on their sides as if they had fallen over in the wind, then farther down the east-west cross street.
Yeah, but people are home. There are lights, he pointed.
Yes, she saw there were lights in some of the houses, but she thought the pattern they made looked random somehow. And there were lights on at that mining place, too, she said. Besides, take a good look. Most of the houses are dark. Now, why is that, do you think? She heard the little sarcastic edge rising in her voice. Didn't like it. Couldn't stop it. Do you think maybe most of the local yokels chartered a bus to go watch the desperation dorks play a doubleheader with the Austin assholes? Big desert rivalry? Something they look forward to all year? Hey, what are you doing? Not that she needed to ask. He was turning west along the cross street. A tumbleweed flew at the truck like something jumping out of the screen at you in a 3D movie. Cynthia cried out and raised an arm over her face. The tumbleweed hit the windshield, bounced, scraped briefly on the roof of the cab, and was gone. This is stupid, she said, and dangerous. He glanced over at her briefly, smiled, nodded. She should have been pissed at him, smiling at a time like this, but she wasn't. It was hard to be pissed at a man who can light up that way, and she knew that was half her damn problem. As Gert Kinshaw back at D&S had been fond of saying, those who do not learn from the past are condemned to get beat up by it. She didn't think Steve Ames was the sort of man who would use his fists on a woman, but that wasn't the only way that men hurt women. They also hurt them by smiling pretty. So pretty, and getting them to follow along into the lion's jaws, usually with a covered dish casserole in their hands. If you know it's dangerous, why are you doing it, Lubbock?
Because we need to find a phone that works, and because I don't trust the way I feel. It's almost dark, and I've got the worst case of the Jim Jams in history. I don't want to let them control me. Look, just let me check a couple of places. You can stay in the truck.
The fuck I... Hey, check it out. Over there.
She pointed at a length of picket fence that had been knocked over and was lying on the lawn of a small frame house. In the glare of the headlights, it was all but impossible to tell what color the house was, but she had no trouble seeing the tire tracks printed on the length of down fence. They were too clear to miss.
A drunk driver could have done that, he said. I saw two bars already, and I haven't even been looking.
A stupid idea, in her opinion, but she was getting to like his Texas accent more and more. Another bad sign.
Come on, Steve, get real.
Coyote howls rose in the night, counterpointing the wind. She slid next to him again.
Jesus, I hate that. What's with them?
I don't know. He was creeping along at no more than 10 miles an hour, wanting to be able to stop before he was on top of anything the headlights might reveal.
Probably smart. What would have been even smarter, in her humble opinion, was a quick turnaround and an even quicker get the hell out of Dodge.
Steve, I can't wait to get somewhere with billboards and bank signs and sleazy used car lots that stay open all night.
I hear you, he said.
And she thought, you don't, though. When people say, I hear you, they almost never do.
Just let me check here, this one house, and then this burg is history, he said, and turned into the driveway of a small, ranch-style home on the left side of the street. They had come perhaps a quarter of a mile west from the intersection. Cynthia could still see the blinker through the flying sand.
There were lights on in the house Steve had picked, bright ones that fell through the shears across the living room window, dimmer, yellowy ones shining through the trio of oblongs set into the front door in a rising diagonal line. He pulled his bandana up over his mouth and nose and then opened the truck door, holding on as the wind tried to rip it out of his hand.
Stay here.
Yeah, right, eat me. She opened her own door, and the wind did pull it away from her. She slid out before he could say anything else.
A hot gust pushed her backward, making her stagger and grab the edge of the door for balance. The sand stung her lips and cheeks, making her wince as she pulled her own bandana up. And the worst thing of all was that this storm might just be warming up. She looked around for coyotes. They sounded close. And saw none. Yet, anyway.
Steve was already climbing the steps to the porch, so much for the protective mail. She went after him, wincing as another strong gust rocked her back on her heels.
We're behaving like characters in a cheap horror movie, she thought dismally. Staying when we know we should go, poking where we have no business poking.
True enough, she supposed, except wasn't that what people did? Wasn't that why, when Richie Judkins had come home in a really badass, ear-ripping mood, little Miss Cynthia had still been there? Wasn't that what most of the bad stuff in the world was about? Staying when you knew damned well you should go? Pushing on when you knew you should cut and run? Wasn't that, in the last analysis, why so many people like cheap horror movies? Because they recognized the scared kids who refused to leave the haunted house even after the murder started as themselves?
Steve was standing on the top step in the howling wind and dust, head hunched down, bandana flapping, and ringing the doorbell. Actually, ringing the bell, like he was going to ask the lady of the house if he could come in and explain the advantages of Sprint over AT&T. It was too much for Cynthia. She pushed rudely past, almost knocking him into the bushes beside the stoop, grabbed the doorknob, and turned it. The door opened. She couldn't see the bottom half of Steve's face because of the bandana, but the look of amazement in his eyes as she followed the opening door into the house was very satisfactory.
"Hey!" she shouted. "Hey, anybody home? Fucking Avon calling you guys."
No answer, but there was a strange noise coming from an open doorway ahead to the right, a kind of hissing. She turned to Steve. "Nobody home, see? Now let's go." Instead,
He started up the hall toward the sound.
No, she whispered fiercely and grabbed his arm. No, N-O, that spells no. Enough is enough.
He shook free without even looking at her. Men, goddamn men, such parfait knightly assholes they were, and went on up the hall.
Hello?
He asked as he went, just so that anyone intent on killing him would know exactly where to look. Cynthia had every intention of going back outside and getting into the truck. She would wait 3 minutes by her watch, and if he wasn't out by then, she'd put the truck in gear and drive away, damned if she wouldn't. Instead, she followed him up the hall.
Hello?
He stopped just short of the open doorway. Maybe he had some sense left, a little anyway, and then cautiously poked one eye around the jam.
Help?
He stopped. That funny hissing was louder than ever now, a shaky sort of sound, loose, almost like... She looked over his shoulder, not wanting to, but not able to help herself. Stephen had gone white above his bandana, and that wasn't a good sign. No, not a hissing, not really. A rattling. It was the dining room. The family had been about to eat what looked like the evening meal, although not this evening's meal, she saw that right away. There were flies buzzing over the pot roast, and some of the slices were already supporting colonies of maggots. The creamed corn had congealed in its bowl. The gravy was a greasy clot in its boat. Three people were seated at the table, a woman, a man, and a baby in a high chair. The woman was still wearing the full-length apron in which she had cooked the meal. The baby wore a bib which read, "I'm a big boy now." He was slumped sideways behind his tray, on which were several stiff-looking orange slices. He regarded Cynthia with a frozen grin. His face was purple. His eyes bulged from puffy sockets like glass marbles. His parents were equally puffed. She could see several pairs of holes on the man's face, small ones, almost hypodermic-sized, one set in the side of his nose. Several large rattlesnakes were on the table, crawling restlessly among the dishes, shaking their tails. As she looked, the bodice of the woman's apron bulged. For one moment, Cynthia thought the woman was still alive in spite of her purple face and glazed eyes, that she was breathing, and then a triangular snake's head pushed up through the ruffles, and tiny black buckshot eyes looked across at her. The snake opened its mouth and hissed. Its tongue danced. And more of them. Snakes on the floor under the table, crawling over the dead man's shoes. Snakes beyond them, in the kitchen. She could see a huge one, a diamondback, slithering along the formica counter beneath the microwave. The ones on the floor were coming for them, and coming fast.
Run!
She shrieked at herself, and found she couldn't move. It was as if her shoes had been glued to the floor. She hated snakes above all creatures. They revolted her in some fundamental sense far below her ability to articulate or understand. And this house was full of them. There could be more behind them, between them and the door. Steve grabbed her and yanked her backward. When he saw she was unable to run, he picked her up and ran with her in his arms, pelting down the hallway and out into the night, carrying her over the threshold and into the dark, like a bridegroom in reverse. 5. Steve, did you see? The door on her side of the truck was still open. He threw her inside, slammed her door, then ran around to his side and got in. He looked through the windshield at the rectangle of light falling through the open door of the ranch house, then at her. His eyes were huge above the bandana.
"Sure I saw," he said. "Every snake in the motherfucking universe, and all of them coming at us."
"I couldn't run,"
Snakes, they scare me so bad. I'm sorry.
My fault for getting us in there in the first place.
He put the truck in reverse and backed jerkily out of the driveway, swinging around so the truck's nose was pointed east toward the fallen bikes, the flattened piece of fence, and the dancing blinker light.
We're getting the fuck back to Highway 50 so fast it'll make your head spin.
He stared at her with horrified perplexity.
They were there, weren't they? I mean, I didn't just hallucinate them. They were there.
Yes. Now go, Steve. Drive.
He did, going faster now, but still not fast enough to be dangerous. She admired his control, especially since he was so obviously rocked back on his heels. At the blinker, he turned left and headed north, back the way they had come.
Try the radio, he said, as the hideous little town at last began to fall behind them. Find some tunes. Just no achy breaky heart. I draw the line at that.
Okay.
She bent forward toward the dash, glancing into the rearview mirror mounted outside her window as she did. For just a moment, she thought she saw a wink of light back there, swinging in an arc. It could have been a flashlight. It could have been some peculiar reflection kicked across the glass by the dancing blinker. Or it could have been just her imagination. She preferred to believe that last one. In any case, it was gone now, smothered in flying dust. She thought briefly about mentioning it to Steve and decided not to. She didn't think he'd want to go back and investigate. She thought he was every bit as freaked out as she was at this point. But it was wise never to underestimate a man's capacity to play John Wayne. But if there are people back there... She gave her head a small, decisive shake. No, she wasn't falling for that. Maybe there were people alive back there, doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs, but there was also something very bad back there. The best thing they could do for any survivors who might remain in desperation was to get help. Besides, I didn't really see anything. I'm almost sure I didn't. She turned on the radio, got a barrage of static all the way across the dial when she pushed the seek button, turned it off again.
Forget it, Steve. Even the local shit-kicking station is...
What the fuck?
He asked in a high, screamy voice that was completely unlike his usual one.
What the blue fuck?
I don't see...
She began, and then she did. Something ahead of them, some huge shape looming in the flying dust. It had big yellow eyes. She put her hands to her mouth, but they weren't quite in time to catch her scream. Steve hit the brakes with both feet. Cynthia, who hadn't fastened her seatbelt, was thrown against the dashboard, just managing to get her forearms up in time to spare her head a bump.
Christ almighty, Steve said. His voice sounded a little more normal. How the hell did that get in the road?
What is it? She asked, and knew even before the question was out of her mouth.
No Jurassic Park monstrosity, her first thought, God help her, and no oversized piece of mining equipment. No big yellow eyes, either. What she'd mistaken for eyes had been the reflection of their own headlights in a sheet of window glass. A picture window, to be exact. It was a trailer, in the road, blocking the road. Cynthia looked to her left and saw that the stake fence between the road and the trailer park had been knocked over. Three of the trailers, the biggest ones, were gone. She could tell where they had been by the cement block foundations upon which they had sat. Those trailers were now drawn across the road, the biggest in front, the others behind it like a secondary wall put up in case the main line of defense is breached. One of these latter two was the rusty airstream on which the Rattlesnake Trailer Park satellite dish had been mounted. The dish itself now lay upended at the edge of the park like a vast black hubcap. It had taken down some lady's clothesline when it fell, pants and shirts flat from it.
Go around, she said.
I can't on this side of the road. The drop-off's too steep. The trailer park side's pretty steep, too, but...
You can do it,
she said, fighting back the quiver in her voice. And you owe me. I went into that house with you.
Okay, okay.
He reached for the transmission lever, probably meaning to drop it into the lowest gear, and then his hand froze in midair. He cocked his head. She heard it a second later, and her first panicky thought was, "They're here. Oh, Jesus, they got in the truck somehow." Of snakes. But this wasn't the same. This was a harsh, whirring sound, almost like a piece of paper caught in a fan, or... Something came falling out of the dancing air above them, something that looked like a big black stone. It hit the windshield hard enough to make a bullet snarl of opacity at the point of impact and send long, silvery cracks shooting out in either direction. Blood. It looked black in this light, splattered across the glass like an ink blot. There was a nasty crack crunch as the kamikaze accordioned in on itself, and for a moment she saw one of its merciless, dying eyes peering in at her. She screamed again, this time making no attempt to muffle it with her hands. There was another hard thud, this one from over their heads. She looked up and saw the roof of the cab was dented down. "Steve, get us out of here!" she cried. He turned on the wipers, and one of them pushed the squashed buzzard down onto the outside air vents. It lay there in a lump like some bizarre tumor with a beak. The other wiper smeared blood and feathers across the glass in a fan. Sand immediately started to stick in this mess. Steve goosed the washer fluid switch. The windshield cleared a little near the top, but the bottom part was hopeless. The hulk of the dead bird made it impossible for the wiper blades to do their job. "Steve," she said. She heard his name coming out of her mouth, but couldn't feel it. Her lips were numb, and her midsection felt entirely gone. No liver, no lights, just an empty place filled with its own whistling windstorm. Under the trailer, coming out from under that trailer. See them? She pointed. He saw. The sand had drifted crosswise along the tar in east-west lines that looked like clutching fingers. Later, if the wind kept up at this pitch, those dunelets would fatten to arms, but now they were just fingers. Emerging from beneath the trailer, strutting like the vanguard of an advancing army, was a battalion of scorpions. She couldn't tell how many. How could she, when she was still finding it difficult to believe she was seeing them at all? Less than 100, probably, but still dozens of them. Dozens. There were snakes crawling among them and behind them, wriggling along in rapid S-shapes, sliding over the ridges of sand with the ease of water moccasins speeding across a pond. "They can't get in here," she told herself. "Take it easy. They can't get in." No, and maybe they didn't want to. Maybe they weren't supposed to. Maybe they were supposed to... Came another of those harsh, whickering sounds, this time on her side of the truck, and she leaned toward Steve, cringed toward Steve, with her right arm held up to protect the side of her face. The buzzard hit the passenger window of the truck like a bomb filled with blood instead of explosive. The glass turned milky and sagged in toward her, holding for the time being. One of the buzzard's wings flapped weakly at the windshield. The wiper on her side tore a chunk of it off. "It's all right," he cried, almost laughing and putting an arm around her as he echoed her thought. "It's okay. They can't get in." "Yes, they can," she shouted back. "The birds can, if we stay here, if we give them time, and the snakes, the scorpions."
"What? What are you saying?"
"Could they make holes in the tires?"
It was the RV she was seeing in her mind's eye, all its tires flat. The RV and the purple-faced man back there in the ranch house, his face tattooed with holes in pairs, holes so small they looked almost like flecks of red pepper.
"They could, couldn't they? Enough of them, all stinging and biting at once. They could.
No, he said, and gave a strange little yawp of laughter. Little bitty desert scorpions 4 inches long, stingers no bigger than thorns. Are you kidding?
But then the wind dropped momentarily, and from beneath them, already from beneath them, they heard scurrying, jostling sounds, and she saw something she could have skipped. He didn't believe what he was saying. He wanted to, but he didn't.
Chapter 4 1
The cellular phone was lying all the way across the holding area, at the foot of a file cabinet with a Pat Buchanan for President sticker on it. The gadget didn't look broken, but... Johnny pulled the antenna and flipped it open. The phone beeped and the S appeared. Good, but there were no transmission bars. Bad. Very bad. Still, he had to try. He pushed the name/menu button until Steve appeared, then squeezed the send button. Mr. Marinville. It was Mary, standing in the doorway. We have to go. The cop? I know. Just a second. Nothing. No ring, no robot, no reception. Just a very faint, hollow roaring sound, the sort of thing you heard in a conch shell. Fucked, he said, and closed the phone's speaker pad. But that was Steve. I know it was. If we'd only gotten outside 30 seconds sooner. 30 cock-sucking little seconds. Johnny, please. Coming. He followed her back downstairs. Mary had the Rossi shotgun in her hand, and when they were back outside, Johnny saw that David Carver had taken back the pistol and was holding it beside his leg. Ralph now held one of the rifles. He had it in the crook of his arm, like he thought he was Dan'l Boone.
Oh, Johnny, a mocking voice spoke up from inside his head.
It was Terry, the never-say-die bitch who had gotten him into this fuckero in the first place.
Don't tell me you're jealous of Mr. Suburban Ohio. You?
Well, maybe. Just a little. Mostly because Mr. Suburban Ohio's rifle was loaded, unlike the Mossberg shotgun which Johnny now picked up.
That's a Ruger 44, the old man was telling Ralph. 4 rounds. I left the chamber empty. If you have to shoot, remember that.
I will, Ralph said.
She'll kick you hard. Remember that, too.
Billingsley lifted the last gun, the .30-06. For a moment, Johnny thought the old fart was going to offer to trade him, but he didn't.
All right, he said. I guess we're ready. Don't shoot at any varmints unless they come at us. You just miss, use up ammunition, and probably draw more. Do you understand that, Carver?
Yes, Ralph said.
Son?
Yes.
Ma'am?
Yes, Mary said. She sounded resigned to being a ma'am, at least until she got back to civilization. And I won't swing unless they get close, I promise, Johnny said. It was supposed to be a joke, a little mood brightener, but all it earned him from Billingsley was a look of cool contempt. It wasn't a look Johnny thought he deserved.
Do you have a problem with me, Mr. Billingsley? He asked. I don't care for your looks much, Billingsley shot back. We don't have much respect out in these parts for older folks who wear their hair long. As to whether or not I have a problem with you, that I couldn't say just yet.
So far as I can see, what you do to folks out in these parts is gut shoot them and then hang them on hooks like deer, so maybe you'll pardon me if I don't take your opinions too deeply to heart. Now listen here. And if that hair's laying across your ass because you missed your daily quart of sour mash, don't take it out on me. He was ashamed at the way the old man's eyes flickered when he said that, and at the same time he was bitterly gratified. You knew your own, by God. There were a lot of know-it-all buttheads in Alcoholics Anonymous, but they were right about that. You knew your own even when you couldn't smell the booze on their breath or wafting out of their pores. You could almost hear them pinging in your head like sonar.
Stop it!
Mary snapped at him. If you want to be an asshole, do it on your own time.
Johnny looked at her, wounded by her tone of voice, wanting to say something childish like, Hey, he started it.
Where should we go? David asked. He shone his light across the street at the Desperation coffee shop and video stop. Over there? The coyotes and the buzzard I saw are gone.
Too close, I think, Ralph said. What about we get out of here completely? Did you find any car keys?
Johnny rummaged and came up with the key ring David had taken from the dead cop.
Only one set on here. I imagine they go to the cruiser Antragian was driving.
Is driving, David said. It's gone. It's what he took my mom away in.
His face, as he said this, was unreadable. His father put a hand on the back of the boy's neck.
It might be safer not to be driving just now anyway, Ralph said. A car's pretty conspicuous when it's the only one on the road.
Any place will do, at least to start with, Mary said.
Any place, yeah, but the farther from the cop's home base, the better, Johnny said. That's the asshole's opinion, anyhow.
Mary gave him an angry look. Johnny bore it, not looking away. After a moment, she did, flustered.
Ralph said, We might do well to hide up, at least for a little while.
Where? Mary asked.
Where do you think, Mr. Billingsley? David asked.
The American West, he said after a moment's thought. Reckon that'd do to start with.
What is it? Johnny asked. A bar?
Movie theater, Mary said. I saw it when he drove us into town. It looks closed up.
Billingsley nodded.
Is. Would have been torn down 10 years ago if there was anything to put up in its place. It's locked, but I know a way in. Come on, and remember what I said about the varmints. Don't shoot unless you have to.
And stay close together, Ralph added. Lead the way, Mr. Billingsley.
Once again, Johnny brought up the rear as they set off north along Main Street, their shoulders hunched against the scouring drive of the west wind. Johnny looked ahead at Billingsley, who just happened to know a way into the town's old deserted movie theater. Billingsley, who turned out to have all sorts of opinions on all sorts of issues once you got him wound up a little.
You're a late-stage alcoholic, aren't you, my friend? Johnny thought. You've got all the bells and whistles.
If so, the man was operating well for one who hadn't had a shot in a while. Johnny wanted something to reduce the throb in his nose, and he suspected that getting a drink into old Tommy at the same time might be an investment in their future. They were passing beneath the battered awning of Desperation's Owls Club.
Hold it, Johnny said, going in here for a minute.
Are you nuts? Mary asked. We have to get off the street.
There's nobody on the street but us, Johnny said. Didn't you notice?
He moderated his voice, tried to sound reasonable.
Look, I just want to get some aspirin. My nose is killing me. 30 seconds, a minute, max.
He tried the door before she could answer. It was locked. He hit the glass with the rifle butt, actually looking forward to the bray of the burglar alarm. But the only sound was the tinkle of glass falling onto the floor inside and the relentless howl of the wind. Johnny knocked out the few jagged bits of glass sticking up from the side of the door frame, then reached through and felt for the lock.
Look, Ralph murmured. He pointed across the street.
4 coyotes stood on the sidewalk in front of a squat brick building with the word Utility printed on one window and Water on the other. They didn't move, but their eyes were trained on the little cluster of people across the street. A 5th came trotting down the sidewalk from the south and joined them.
Mary raised the Rossi and pointed it toward the coyotes. David Carver pushed it down again. His face was distant, abstracted.
No, it's all right, he said. They're just watching.
Johnny found the lock, turned it, and opened the door. The light switches were to the left. They turned on a bank of old-fashioned fluorescents, the kind that looked like inverted ice cube trays. These illuminated a little restaurant area, deserted, a cluster of slot machines, dark, and a pair of blackjack tables,
Hanging from one of the light fixtures was a parrot. Johnny at first thought it must be stuffed, but when he got a little closer, he observed the bulging eyes and the splatter of mixed blood and guano on the wood below it. It was real enough. Someone had strung it up. Entragian must not have liked the way it said, "Polly want a cracker," Johnny thought. The owl smelled of old hamburgers and beer. At the far end of the room was a little shopping area. Johnny took a large bottle of generic aspirin, then went behind the bar. "Hurry up," Mary cried at him. "Hurry up, can't you?" "Right there," he said. A man in dark pants and a shirt that had once been white was lying on the dirty linoleum floor, staring up at Johnny with eyes as glassy as those of the hanged parrot. The bartender, from the look of his clothes. His throat had been cut. Johnny pulled a quart of Jim Beam off the shelf. He held it up to the light for a moment, checking the level, then hurried out. A thought, not a nice one, tried to surface, and he shoved it back down, hard. He wanted to lubricate the old horse doctor, that was all. Keep him loose. When you got right down to it, it was an act of Christian charity. "You're more than a sweetheart," Terry said inside his head. "You're really a saint, aren't you? Saint John the Lubricator." And then her cynical laughter. "Shut up, bitch," he thought. But as always, Terry was reluctant to go. 2. "Be cool, Stephen," he told himself. "It's the only way you'll get out of this. If you panic, I think there's a good chance both of you are going to die in this goddamn rented truck." He put the transmission in reverse, and, steering by the outside mirror, he didn't dare open his door and lean out. It would be too easy for a dive-bombing buzzard to break his neck. Began to move backward. The wind had picked up again, but he could still hear the crunching from under the truck as they rolled over the scorpions. It reminded him of how cereal sounded when you were chewing it. "Don't drive off the side. For Christ's sake, don't do that." "They're not following," Cynthia said. The relief in her voice was unmistakable. He took a look, saw she was right, and stopped. He had backed up about 50 feet, far enough so that the lead trailer across the road was just a vague shape in the blowing sand again. He could see brown blotches against the whitish-gray sand in the road. Squashed scorpions. From here they looked like pats of cow dung. And the others were retreating. In another moment he would find it hard to believe they had been there at all. "Oh, they were," he thought. "If you start doubting that, old buddy, all you have to do is take a look at the dead bird currently blocking the air vents at the bottom of the windshield." "What do we do now?" she asked. "I don't know." He looked out his window and saw the Desert Rose Cafe. Half of its pink awning had come down in the wind. He looked out the other window, past Cynthia, and saw a vacant lot with 3 boards nailed across the entrance. "Keep out of here," had been painted across the centerboard in sloppy white capitals, presumably by someone who didn't believe in Western hospitality. "Something wants to keep us in town," she said. "You know that, don't you?" He backed the rider into the parking lot of the Desert Rose, trying to think of a plan. What came instead was a series of disjointed images and words. The doll lying face down at the bottom of the RV's steps. The tractors saying her name was Emergency and her telephone number was 911. Johnny Cash saying he built it one piece at a time. Bodies on hooks, a tiger fish swimming between the fingers of the hand at the bottom of the aquarium, the baby's bib, the snake on the kitchen counter under the microwave. He realized he was on the edge of panic, maybe on the edge of doing something really stupid, and groped for anything that would pull him back from the edge, get him thinking straight again. What came to his mind, unbidden, was something he never would have expected. It was an image, clearer than any of the preceding ones, of the piece of stone sculpture they had seen on the computer table in the Mining Corporation's Quonset. the coyote with the strange twisted head and the starting eyeballs, the coyote whose tongue had been a snake.
There ought to be a picture of that thing next to ugly in the dictionary, Cynthia had said, and she was right about that. Oh, yes, no question. But Steve was suddenly overwhelmed by the idea that anything that ugly also had to be powerful.
Are you kidding? He thought distractedly. The radio turned on and off when you touched it. The lights flickered. The aquarium fucking exploded. Of course it's powerful.
What was that little piece of statuary we found back there? He asked. What was up with that?
I don't know. I only know that when I touched it...
What? When you touched it, what?
It seemed like I remembered every rotten thing that ever happened to me in my life, she said. Sylvia Marcucci spitting on me in the 8th grade out in the playground. She said I stole her boyfriend, and I didn't even know who the hell she was talking about. The time my dad got drunk at my Aunt Wanda's 2nd wedding and felt my ass while we were dancing and pretended it was a mistake, like his hard-on was a mistake, too. Her hand crept to the side of her head. Getting yelled at. Getting dumped on. Richie Judkins almost ripping my fucking ear off. I thought of all those things.
Yeah, but what did you really think of?
She looked for a moment as if she were going to tell him not to be a wise ass, and then didn't.
Sex, she said, and let out a shaky sigh. Not just fucking, either. All of it. The dirtier the better. Yes, he thought. The dirtier, the better. Things you might like to try, but would never talk about. Experimental stuff.
What are you thinking about?
Her voice was oddly sharp, at the same time oddly pungent, like a smell. Steve looked over at her and suddenly wondered if her pussy was tight. An insane thought to be having at a time like this, but it was what came into his head.
Steve?
Sharper than ever.
What are you thinking?
Nothing, he said. His voice was thick, the voice of a man struggling out of a deep sleep. Nothing. Never mind.
Does it start with C and end with E?
Actually, my dear, cunt ends with a T, but you're in the ballpark.
What was wrong with him? What, in God's name? It was as if that funny piece of rock had turned on another radio, this one in his head, and it was broadcasting a voice that was almost his own.
What are you talking about? He asked her.
Coyote, coyote, she said, lilting the words like a child. No, she wasn't accusing him of anything. Although he supposed that briefly thinking so had been a natural enough mistake, she was just falling all over herself in excitement. The thing we saw back in the lab. If we had it, we could get out of here. I know we could, Steve. And don't waste my time, our time, by telling me I'm crazy.
Considering the stuff they had seen and the stuff that had happened to them in the last 90 minutes or so, he had no intention of doing that. If she was crazy, they both were. But
you told me not to touch it.
He was still struggling to talk. It was as if there were mud packed into his thinking equipment.
You said it felt...
Felt what? What had she said?
Nice. That was it. Touch it, Steve. It feels nice.
No. Wrong.
You said it felt nasty.
She smiled at him. In the green glow of the dash lights, the smile looked cruel. You want to feel something nasty? Feel this.
She took his hand, put it between her legs, and twitched her hips upward twice. Steve closed his hand on her down there, hard enough to hurt, maybe, but her smile stayed on,
widened even. What are we doing? And why in God's name are we doing it now?
He heard the voice, but it was almost lost. Like a voice screaming fire in a ballroom full of yelling people and jagged music. The cleft between her legs was closer, more urgent. He could feel it right through her jeans, and it was burning. Burning.
She said her name was Emergency and asked to see my gun, Steve thought. You're going to see it all right, honey. 38 pistol on a 45 frame, shoots tombstone bullets with a ball and chain. He made a tremendous effort to catch hold of himself, grabbing for anything that would shut the pile down before the containment rods melted. What he got hold of was an image, the curious